In our second case this morning, 2022-1286, in the matter of the State of Ohio, State ex rel. Dave Yost, Ohio Attorney General versus First Energy Corp. in the City of Cincinnati. As everyone can see, we have a new member to the court this morning, Judge Lewis from the Second District Court of Appeals. Thank you for sitting in place of Justice Dieters today.
Good morning. Thank you.
On behalf of the appellant, Charles Miller, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Here with me today at council table is Martine Cordero, Assistant Attorney General. I'm a former Deputy Attorney General with the office and currently here today as pro bono special counsel. I'll try to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, we're here today on a decision from the Court of Appeals that was made without jurisdiction because there was not a final appealable order with respect to the attachment. This became very clear in the both in the order itself from the Court of Appeals and how appellee Mr. Randazzo has characterized the status of this matter both there and here. This attachment proceeding proceeded in a way similar to a analogous to a TRO and preliminary injunction is how it should have proceeded. There was the ex parte hearing, and then there should have been the contested hearing. Mr. Randazzo says that he never requested a contested hearing, and we never, in fact, had a contested hearing. He filed a motion to vacate, refused to put on evidence, and the court refused to permit us to put on evidence and said, no, we're not having a contested hearing. And under the final appealable order analysis, the only order that could be final and appealable is the actual order from the contested hearing. Because, you know, just like with the TRO and preliminary injunction, you have sort of the emergency order that takes place.
Well, why wouldn't, I mean, I understand that the process that was followed was not was set forth in the rules. Why wouldn't we treat the order as the denial of a motion to dissolve an attachment? Isn't that functionally what it was?
So, Your Honor, that was the position that we took at the Court of Appeals, is, you know, like, they did this a little sloppy, we should be generous about this, but what we ended up have happen, though, was the Court of Appeals basically said that we were correct sort of on the merits of obtaining it, but what they said was as well, but if you look at the ex parte nature of the initial hearing, that was wrong. Well, the initial hearing is not appealable because that goes away, because you would have the contested hearing and the result there. And so that issue could never be decided by the Court of Appeals, ever. And even if you look at the merits of that decision, saying that the order should not have been issued ex parte, that's just simply wrong to begin with anyway on the merits. It's a matter that should be reviewed. These matters are reviewed for abuse of discretion, so very high standard. And the only thing that the court had to make at the trial level was a probable cause determination, one, that Mr. Randazzo was in, met one of the factors, and he met three of them. But then with respect to it being ex parte, that there was an immediate danger that he would take action to make it difficult for us to collect. And there were plenty of badges of fraud here. We have a scenario where he was raided by the FBI, First Energy, a publicly traded public utility, admitted in federal court in a deferred prosecution agreement to paying him a $4.3 million bribe. We have the fact that after that, he's potentially on the hook to us and to others, and just on us alone on this claim, it's treble damages. So he's insolvent at this point, and what does he do? He gives away a house to his son. He liquidates a bunch of other properties and takes the proceeds. These aren't mortgage properties, so he's actually receiving the proceeds, puts them in a brokerage account. there's all evidence here that's in place that it seems like he is going to move funds. He does move those funds, sends them off to California to a law firm out there. And so the state has to have the ability, when you have the state as being the victim here of this criminal conduct, the ability for recovery of the proceeds of the criminal bribe.
Was it appropriate for him to put the proceeds in his IOLTA account?
If we have a scenario where we can get to a point where there's funds that are being held in an IOLTA account and they're not being used, that's something we would certainly agree to and stipulate.
But if the funds were personal to him, could he mingle those with, and I'm looking at this in terms of what the trial court could have looked at in determining what the motive was, because why would an attorney who maintains funds for clients be permitted to commingle those personal funds unless they were for some corporate entity that he was holding them for?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. He did not put them in his own IOLTA account. They were deposited with two different firms. One is a criminal defense firm based in California. I believe he's using Chicago-based attorneys, but the funds went to California. That was, I believe, $2.5 million. And then $500,000 went to his attorney who was appearing here today for the purpose of spending those down. Yeah, so he's depleting the assets, which is the issue we have here. And we've cited other cases where funds and IOLTA accounts, have been.
Help me understand what has been frozen. So part of the issue is the garnishment.
Yeah.
What accounts have been garnished and how much, what's the status? Are these been paid in the court? Are they frozen by the brokerage firm? Are there bank accounts? What's the amount here?
Yes, so
I couldn't find any of that in the record.
Correct. So the brokerage firm froze the amount that was still there,
which was
about $700,000. And then there were two banks here in Columbus, one Fifth Third and the other Huntington, that both froze funds, which I believe collectively comprised less than $200,000. But they were frozen, and at least the brokerage funds and I believe the Fifth Third funds were not paid to court. I think at some point Huntington initially did that, but then I don't know if they were accepted by the court clerk, or if that was ended up being returned and just held as frozen.
So we're talking about about $1 million that has been frozen.
We also then, the intention then was is that we requested the court then order garnishment of the funds that we tracked to the attorney accounts, because those can't be spent as well. It's the same funds. So we're just chasing the funds at that point in time. We requested that. We received a stipulation from counsel to hold those funds pending this issue.
Counsel.
So how much is that?
That would be $3 million and more.
Counsel, the one figure I saw was $8 million, and yet
yes.
Reading your complaint and affidavit, it's $4.3 million.
Yeah, so it's $4.3 treble.
But with treble, we haven't gotten that far yet, right?
Well, treble.
So how does $8 million doesn't treble 4.3 anyway?
That's right, but it's less. So the claim automatically under the RICO statute is treble damages. And so we go to the court and say we're entitled to treble damages. We're not requesting that amount because, what we're mostly concerned about is the bribe. And also, we told him, quite frankly, we don't know that we could find, $12 million anyway. So we just requested a lesser number.
But the $4.3 million is in your affidavit, right?
Yeah, $4.3 million. Treble.
Then where's $8 million come from?
It's not 12, it's 13. It's less than 13 because it's less than the treble damages. That's what we're entitled to. So that's the amount that's there. But again, this isn't reviewable. And if the court would determine, that is wrong, well, then the order there isn't to dissolve everything and say, this attachment is invalid, this garnishment is invalid. You just reduce the number. You just order it reduced.
Well, so let me ask you about that. So assume that we agree with the state on the first three propositions, that we think that this was that we think that the Court of Appeals erred, that we agree that
the order under review isn't the ex parte order, but it's the order after the motion to dissolve an attachment.
Correct.
But we're troubled by the garnishment, which the discrepancy in the amount of money that was represented in the court and then what was in the order, and we're troubled by the fact that there was basically the forms and procedures for post-judgment garnishment were followed when this was really a pre-judgment garnishment. What is the remedy there? Does that go back to the trial court? Does that go back to the Court of Appeals? Do we dissolve the whole thing?
All right. So, well, I mean, before you could get to there, you'd have to determine that Mr. Randazzo would have the ability to appeal the garnishment order, which was an order that was issued to the financial institutions. And all that said was, the issue that the Court of Appeals found with that is that the clerk of court required us to put to additionally use a form, in addition to everything that we submitted under 2715, to use a form that said that the state is a judgment creditor and that he is a judgment debtor. Well,
There's a whole procedure for a pre-judgment garnishment that's different than for a post-judgment garnishment. I mean, pre-judgment garnishments, you can essentially seize the funds and then come to court. Pre-judgment garnishments, by statute, you're supposed to bring the debtor to court first.
Your Honor, what happens with pre-judgment garnishment is you get the ex parte order, and it's just simply a garnishment order. You send it to the financial institutions, at which point they file an answer. That is all the same. The only difference the major difference between the two of them is that with the pre-judgment garnishment, you cannot garnish wages. And the order itself, the garnishment order, says not for wages. That's what it says. Not for personal earnings. We didn't want that. We didn't request them to do that. And this is a judgment. If you look at the closest statute that I could find, you know, you look at the revised code and you think, hey, they're going to define these terms, right? There's going to be a definition of judgment here somewhere. And, you know, I looked, and the only place I could find something that is similar to this is actually in the statute on execution, which sort of makes sense, right? And it's the closest definition is actually for foreign judgments, which is 2329.021. And what it says is a foreign judgment means any judgment, decree, or order from a court of the United States or any other state entitled to full faith and credit. So any judgment, decree, or order. So, and you know, that essentially can be executed, right? It's an order that can be executed. That's what a judgment is. You know, it doesn't have to be a final judgment at the end of the case. It's just a judgment. And so the clerk of court required us to submit that form. We submitted it. We included everything that was required under 2715. So there was no error here. There was no error whatsoever with respect to that and the use of those forms. If you want to say that, you know, that because the affidavit says 4.3 million and we say, hey, this should be trebled, and he said, yes, trebled, and we'll pick a number less than that. If you think that that's a problem and you want to say 4.3, fine, send it back to the trial court and say change it to 4.3. That doesn't change anything that's happened here. All it changes is the maximum amount of the garnishment that can be held. It doesn't change the amount that can be garnished from any institution, because Fifth Third doesn't know how much Charles Schwab is sending in. Huntington doesn't know how much Fifth Third's sending in. You know, so they just say, hey, this is what we got. They answer, this is what we got. We froze it. Tell us what to do with it. What's happened here.
What do you say to the Court of Appeals analysis of the trial court making very cursory findings?
Yeah, that's offensive to the trial court.
It might be, but is
yeah,
it accurate?
So
and is it accurate and or relevant?
Well, you know, it's not relevant. You know, there's no requirements here under the statute as far as, you know, magic language that should be used or anything that should happen. There's no requirement to a length of hearing. In fact, there's no requirement for a hearing whatsoever. But the court here, you know, had the materials in chambers for a substantial amount of time before coming out. And additionally, this was not a new case. The court was familiar with the case. This was the fourth time we were before the judge. It was at least the fourth time. There had been three previous preliminary injunctions that had been filed. Two of them went to hearing. One of them was resolved right before hearing. There were motions to dismiss. He was very, very familiar with the facts of this case, even before he walked in, before he reviewed the documents. He knew what he was doing. He knew what the facts here were. It wasn't difficult of a decision for him to make in this case, as egregious as it is. And if there are no other questions, I will sit down and reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Sugarman, good morning.
Good morning.
Do
Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court, along with Jeff Corcoran sitting with me at council table, we represent the appellees in this case. I know you have a lot of questions, but I cannot overstate the importance of the issues before this court. Prejudgment attachment, especially on an ex parte basis, especially undertaken by the state, is an extraordinary remedy that calls into question not only individuals' constitutional rights, it calls into question deprivation of property. The legislature couldn't have written a more detailed statute setting out steps, setting out statutory requirements,
legislature wrote a statute that provided a procedure for someone to follow who felt that they had been aggrieved by a prejudgment attachment. And I'm not clear whether you are saying you followed that procedure or not. Did you file a motion to dissolve an attachment?
I think our motion to vacate, we filed a motion to vacate, Your Honor. That's the answer to your question.
Okay, well, that's not what's provided in the statute.
Well, what I think Your Honor asked in response to earlier questions and said, the effect of the order not vacating the prejudgment attachment order clearly fits within 2715-46.
So your position is it was a motion to dissolve the attachment?
Well, the trial court treated it as such. The state of Ohio did not object to the motion to vacate or anything at that hearing.
Why isn't the remedy for anything that occurred inappropriate or wrong in the ex parte hearing, and your remedy is now to appeal from that based on the motion to dissolve the attachment.
2715-46 provides the right of appeal to a party to a civil suit who is affected by an order refusing to discharge a prejudgment attachment. That's what happened here, and we took that up to the Court of Appeals.
Okay, but then why doesn't I guess what I don't understand is, now that you've had that hearing, what's your objections to the initial order, ex parte order, how those are relevant on appeal? I mean, it seems to me that once you've had the motion to dissolve the attachment, your remedy is an appeal from that. Where you had the opportunity to present any evidence you wanted to.
We did appeal from that, Your Honor. There were three grounds for the appeal to the Court of Appeals, as you know. And there were three assignments of error, all of which were upheld unanimously by that Court of Appeals, finding that the state did not follow the statutory procedures to obtain an ex parte order. And on the basis of...
But once you've had that hearing, How are those objections cognizable anymore?
I guess I'm sorry, but I'm having trouble following, Your Honor.
Well, once you've had the hearing to dissolve, you've had all the statutory protections that come with that hearing. I don't understand. It's just like a TRO and a preliminary injunction. I don't understand how you can challenge the ex parte point at that part.
Well, there's several grounds. There's a case of Thompson versus Summit Pain Specialist, Your Honor, that we cite in our brief, in which Ohio courts have recognized an order of prejudgment attachment as a final appealable order, which appellate courts have jurisdiction. In that particular case, that court cites the decision of this court in 1855, recognizing attachment proceedings as a special proceeding affecting a substantial right. So there's really two grounds for an appeal to the Court of Appeals. Our fundamental error claimed in the Court of Appeals, and if Your Honors look at which I'm sure you have, if you look at the record, if you look at the steps that were followed, the statute was not applied in a way in which it was intended to be. An example of that would be, Your Honor, the second proposition of law here. If you adopted that, you would cut out half of the statutory requirements under 2715-045.
But weren't you arguing that you had not been served with notice and that you had the right to contest this? And you were really arguing form over substance and then refused to
to put on testimony and do anything that was substantive in that hearing. And so your argument to the Court of Appeals was sort of a meta argument on procedure, wasn't it?
No. Respectfully, no. That was the characterization of the state. If you believe the statute's a meta argument, and if you believe you don't have to follow
the statute, but the fact that you weren't willing to acknowledge that you essentially got the hearing, even though it was before the formal procedures of notice went through.
We had several assignments of error, not all of which were adopted by the Court of Appeals. Readily admit that. What they reversed on was the fundamental failure of the Attorney General in this case, seeking this order to follow what the statute requires and what the trial court must do in order to issue an ex parte. 2715-045 clearly states not only is there must, the burden of proof in this case is on the Attorney General at the outset. And that burden of proof in an ex parte attachment order requires probable cause to support the motion, which means the movement is likely to succeed on the merits and obtain a money judgment in the amount that can be collected, plus, not stopping there. And that's essentially what the second proposition of law is asking you to do, to stop there, just look at probable cause. But the statute goes on and says that also, at that point in time, the movement, in his case, the Attorney General, must show that the movement will suffer irreparable injury if the order is delayed until the defendant against whom the motion has been filed has been given an opportunity to be heard. And then the statute also has, you can only make that finding if there are two circumstances that the trial court is required to follow. Now, it's an arcane statute, but none of this was done.
I'm sorry, I'm asking a question, but again, isn't there was at the hearing an opportunity to be heard. So those extraordinary factors about ex parte relief, they don't come into play anymore once that happens, correct? You've had the opportunity to be heard, so I don't understand what you had that opportunity at the hearing.
But,
so I don't understand how your argument can be, well, we had this ex parte order for a few days before we had the opportunity to be heard. So now, therefore, that ex parte standard applies throughout, even after we've had the opportunity to be heard.
So, Judge, it doesn't stop at the opportunity to be heard. If you go through the statute, there's two steps, again, after opportunity to be heard. You have to find irreparable injury. There is a present danger that the property will be immediately disposed of. The value of the property will be impaired substantially. Now, those are findings that the statute places upon the trial court to make as a result of an ex parte attachment order. These findings were no end. The findings need to be supported by evidence, not just an affidavit that mirrors the statute, that recites the statute, and parrots the statute. And if you look in the record, both of the ex parte hearing, the transcripts are both in the record, at that hearing, ex parte, and then at the hearing on the motion to vacate, there are no evidence that supports these fundamental elements of the statute. That was the problem the Court of Appeals had with the whole issue of ex parte attachment orders in this circumstance, and how the court determined that there was...
So let's presume for a second that it shouldn't have been issued ex parte. The question under the statute after there's been a hearing is, one, whether the state is likely to obtain a money judgment. That's 2715.011. And two, whether one of the 11 grounds under 2715.01 exist. So, I mean, that's the standard at a hearing. So you've had your hearing. That's the standard. Which one of those do you think, or would you say is your strongest argument?
Well, I would say, first of all, under 2715.011, the state has not shown that there's probable cause to support the motion. They've nowhere shown the ability to obtain a judgment. They have a money judgment against the defendant. They have various claims. They have asserted various claims. The money amount of which is unknown. But if you look at the fundamental action pending in the Common Pleas Court, is it a ratepayer action in which this court knows that ratepayers have relief at the Public Utilities Commission, not in the Common Pleas Court? Or is there some amount of damages of which no evidence, I mean, the state, again, this is a heavy burden of proof shouldered by the state in which No evidence of any amount of damages has ever been introduced.
Was the state wrong to rely on the deferred prosecution agreement from the federal prosecution?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's no more of an, it's an allegation. It's like in the prior case where Justice DeWine asked counsel, well, it's hearsay.
Didn't First Energy?
First Energy doesn't bind Mr. Randazzo in any way, shape, or form. First Energy bought its way out of a criminal prosecution by agreeing to pay $230 million. And they made some other admissions. But if you look, when you read our brief and look at the record, there's no, every statement made against Mr. Randazzo in that case that was relied upon is hearsay. It's unsupported evidence. In federal case, which you pointed out, there is no proponent offered by First Energy who could substantiate any of the claims in that first, in the deferred prosecution agreement. So is it a basis that satisfies 2715?
This is probable cause, though. This is probable cause. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's probable cause to support the motion, which means the plaintiff, it's a defined statutory term, it's just not a probable cause hearing. The plaintiff has to show that they'll obtain a judgment against the defendant against whom the motion was filed. These words in the statute, as your honors know, have meaning. And these are the steps, even in all aspects, in the briefing, in the arguments, the state glosses over what the underlying statute requires. And I can't implore you enough to look at the statute as to the steps that are required. This is exactly what the Court of Appeals did. And there is no case law, there is no statute that says that the Court of Appeals was wrong in what they did and how they did it and went about it. They looked at the fundamental underpinnings of this extraordinary remedy and found that there was no evidence.
Why was the Court of Appeals able to even review that prejudgment attachment under 2505.02? Can you explain that to us?
Well, I tried earlier, and I'm sorry, I wasn't clear, because there are cases that say that the ex parte attachment order is a final order that's appealable because it is issued in a special proceeding that affects a substantial right. That's one under 2505.02. Secondly, under 2715.46, it's an order that refuses to discharge an attachment that affects Mr. Randazzo. That's the other grounds for appeal to the trial, to the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, on review, your opposing colleague says it's all abuse of discretion. Do you agree with that?
I believe that the Court of Appeals looked at both a de novo review on questions of law, and then there's an abuse of discretion standard to review the evidence. Opposing counsel says appellate courts can only look at questions of law. That's the language in 2715.46. But, Your Honor, as you know, questions of law is a defined term, again, in a statute. 2501.01a2 defines an appeal on questions of law means a review of a cause upon questions of law, including the weight and sufficiency of the evidence. So, looking at the weight and sufficiency of the evidence, you know the standard better than I do. And was there sufficient evidence in the record? And the Court of Appeals said no. But the first proposition of law says courts of appeals can't even look at the facts. And if you look at every reported case under 2715, every court of appeals that has ruled has looked at the underlying evidence to determine its sufficiency to support an order of prejudgment attachment.
So you're saying the review of the facts is in order to support the review of the law? And that's where, because the statute says the appeal is only on questions of law to reverse, vacate, or modify as in other cases.
Right, and if you look at, Your Honor, if 2501A2 defines the term appeal on questions of law, and that statute says that questions of law, a review by a court of appeals, includes the weight and sufficiency of the evidence. And that's exactly not only what this court does, but every court, in every reported case that both parties cite before this court, every court of appeals has reviewed the sufficiency and weight of the evidence, again, to determine whether this extraordinary ex parte prejudgment order is somehow supportable under the statute.
You said
2501A2. 2501.01, I'm sorry.
I understand, but that's just plain appellate review. 2505.02 deals with the question of jurisdiction. The two statutes you cited regarding jurisdiction were the basic one, 2505.02, and then 2715.46. Right. So it when you're pulling in the other information from 2501, are you certain we can really apply it in these limited circumstances when the statute's very specific about questions of law in 2517.46?
Well, the statute can't. Yes, the answer is yes, Your Honor. I believe you can. I believe you should. If the question is specificity of statute, again, I can implore you to look at the specificity of what has taken place here below in the record and what is required to take place in order to get a prejudgment ex parte attachment. And they couldn't be more different in terms of quantum and lack of evidence that was supported. My time is up. And unless there's other questions, I would love to talk more, but I will yield unless there are questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Miller, you have a minute, 19 seconds left.
I hope not to use all of it, Your Honor. Just briefly on that, on the 2505.02, with respect to the provisional remedy, it has to be a final appealable order, it has to be final regarding that provisional remedy. This wasn't final because you had the next hearing, the contested hearing a few days later. And, you know, we didn't raise this on appeal because we had won, but, like, we didn't actually have that full contested hearing because, you know, we had submitted the additional evidence of, hey, these funds migrated further, we want those garnishments. But we also attempted to subpoena Mr. Randazzo to the hearing because, you know, it's a contested hearing at that point. We want to put on evidence, you know, let's put him on the stand. And that was quashed. We weren't allowed to have him, you know. He probably would have taken the fifth, but that would, you know, we'd been able to use that to our advantage, but, you know, or ask him questions. So we didn't really have that contested hearing to put on that additional evidence so that these things that he's saying, well, we don't know about this, we don't know about that. Had this happened properly, all of those questions would have been answered. If there are no other questions, I'll sit down.
I do have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So essentially, a Court of Appeals finding of abuse of discretion when sort of the framework we're looking at is under 2505.02 and 2517.46 in terms of what the Court of Appeals had the ability to deal with?
Yes.
So if you're saying that the prejudgment attachment was a cursory that was basically trumped by the actual hearing that Mr. Randazzo requested and that was held, you're essentially saying the Court of Appeals made a judgment on something it had no authority to do, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. And if we were to follow kind of down this chain and to say that, hey, you know, sufficiency of evidence is a legal question, at that point, it's just like, is there some evidence? Because this is, you know, it's abusive discretion standard. Was there some evidence to support badges of fraud here that the money was going to move on? Yeah, there was lots of evidence because of his actions and also the further migration of the money. So.
And you don't buy the argument that Mr. Sugarman made that in doing the legal evaluation or the legal review that you have to necessarily look at the facts?
Of course not. No. It's just the only way you look at the facts is you know, were there some facts presented to those issues? That would be the most that it could be. It's like, is there just a sort of a checklist? Did they present some evidence of potential harm in here? There was lots of evidence of it. You know, one, it was criminal action. There was the gifting of the house, liquidation of millions and millions of dollars of assets that were just put into a brokerage account. Then the further transfers beyond that, spending. This is spending down of criminal proceeds, is what it is. That's exactly what's happening here. You know, this is similar to what happened in ECOT. But you know, somebody receives these criminal proceeds, bribe money, as an employee of the state. To take action that benefited FirstEnergy for billions of dollars. And he just wants to be able to take that money, run off with it, spend it down, use it, move it around, give things to his children so that he's judgment-proof at the end of the day, and that has to be stopped. Thank you.
Marshall, call recess.
All rise.